Hello from the Talking Information Centre. This is Alison Davies on Wednesday, February the 18th, reading from the USA Today. From the front page, Jesse Jackson, 1941 to 2026. The civil rights icon lived for justice. Rainbow Push Coalition founder battled even in illness, by Trevor Hughes. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, a towering civil rights icon who battled alongside Martin Luther King Jr., negotiated global hostage releases and shamed corporations for their lack of corporate diversity and failure to support voting rights, has died. Jackson was a Presidential Medal of Freedom recipient, a Democratic presidential candidate, and one of the world's best-known black activists. He was 84 and had suffered from progressive supranuclear palsy, a rare disease that causes a decline similar to Parkinson's disease, but accelerated. It is with profound sadness that we announce the passing of civil rights leader and founder of the Rainbow Push Coalition, the Honourable Reverend Jesse Louis Jackson Sr., said a statement from the organisation. He died peacefully on Tuesday morning, surrounded by his family. Despite the illness that softened his voice and weakened his steps, Jackson had continued to advocate for civil rights, and was arrested twice in 2021 over his objection to the Senate filibuster rule. That same year, he and his wife Jacqueline were hospitalized with COVID-19 complications at the Chicago hospital. His longevity is part of the story, said Rashad Robinson, the former president of a 7-million-member online justice organization called Color of Change. This is someone who had so many chances to do something else, and this is what he chose to do with his life. Jackson's death comes amid a rising tide of white nationalism and voting rights access issues, and follows the loss of other civil rights icons, including former Representative John Lewis, who died in 2020. President Donald Trump said he'd worked with Jackson for decades, providing office space for his coalition. Jackson has previously said he and Trump had split over the fate of the Central Park Five, the group of Hispanic and black teens convicted but ultimately exonerated in the 1989 sexual assault of a woman in New York's Central Park. Trump had taken out newspaper advertisements calling for the teens to be executed. Jesse was a force of nature like few others before him, Trump said in a social media post. He loved his family greatly, and to them I send my deepest sympathies and condolences. Jesse will be missed. Born in Greenville, South Carolina, Jackson's rise to prominence began after he and seven other men were arrested in 1960. He was 18 at the time, for protesting segregation at their town's public library. He then joined Martin Luther King's burgeoning civil rights fight and was just feet away when King was assassinated in 1968. Jackson founded what would ultimately become the Rainbow Push Coalition, and ran for president as a Democrat in 1984-1988, energizing and registering millions of black voters. As we continue in the struggle for human rights, remember that God will see us through, even in our midnight moments, Jackson said in 2017, as he announced his neuromuscular disease diagnosis. Jackson visited Minneapolis in 2021 to support protesters awaiting the verdict in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former police officer who was convicted days later of killing George Floyd in an incident that set off national protests and violence. While there, he also attended services for Daunte Wright, a black man who was shot and killed by a police officer during a protest against police violence in a nearby suburb. Speaking in a subdued voice, Jackson reminded the young activists leading a protest march that their cause was just. In a statement, civil rights attorney Ben Crump mourned his friend as someone who helped shape his own life. Crump has become the go-to lawyer for black families seeking justice and represented some of Floyd's family members. Crump said Jackson helped broaden the path for people of color to shape America through politics and public life. Reverend Jackson conceived of a more just and inclusive America, believed in it with unwavering faith, and dedicated his entire life to achieving it, all while teaching the next generation how to carry the torch forward, Crump said. He was an unstoppable and formidable force, proving that no opponent or battle was too big. Born in the fall of 1941 to a teenage mother and her married neighbor, Jackson was adopted by the man his mother married, and he considered both to be his fathers. He attended a segregated high school and played football in college, dropping out a few credits short of his master's degree in divinity in 1966 to join the civil rights movement full-time. By 1965, he'd marched with King and others from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, to push for black voting rights, and by 1967, was running operations for King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Chicago, the city that would become his home. Under Jackson, the SCLC's Operation Breadbasket used boycotts and public attention to pressure companies to hire more black workers. Jackson ultimately earned his divinity degree after being ordained a minister in 1968. In 1983, shortly before announcing his run for president, Jackson traveled to Syria to negotiate the release of an American pilot shot down over Lebanon. And the next summer, he negotiated the release of 22 Americans and 26 political prisoners from Cuba after meeting with dictator Fidel Castro. His successes bolstered his presidential campaign. Although he lost the 1984 Democratic primary to Walter Mondale, who went on to lose to Ronald Reagan. Jackson ran again for president in 1988, putting on a strong showing, but ultimately falling to Mike Dukakis, who lost to Republican George H.W. Bush. After that second loss, Jackson shelved his own political aspirations, but continued his efforts for civil rights and justice. In 1990, Jackson opposed the pending invasion of Iraq and negotiated the release of hundreds of people whom Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein had threatened to use as human shields. And then in 1999, won the release of three US POWs during the Kosovo War. Robinson, the former president of Color of Change, remembers listening and watching as his family members made their first political donations after listening to one of Jackson's presidential campaign speeches. "I didn't understand everything he said, but I understood what it meant," said Robinson, who later wrote a college paper on Jackson's campaigns. "He was such a possibility model. There are so many people who are in politics today who would not be where they are today, thanks to Jesse Jackson. There certainly would be no Barack Obama if there was no Jesse Jackson, and there would have been no Bill Clinton either." In 2000, Clinton awarded Jackson the Presidential Medal of Freedom, citing his decades of work to make the world a better place. "It's hard to imagine how we could have come as far as we have without the creative power, the keen intellect, the loving heart, and the relentless passion of Jesse Lewis Jackson," Clinton said. Traherne Cruz, who helped found the Black Lives Matter Minnesota chapter, said he grew up with Jackson's "I Am Somebody" recitations ringing in his ears. Jackson often led crowds in a call-and-answer chant that usually included variations on "I may be poor, but I am somebody. I may be young, but I am somebody." That allowed future generations to stand up and follow in his footsteps and declare Black Lives Matter and recognize our humanity, Cruz said. When we go back and watch videos of Reverend Jackson marching and fighting for housing rights, voting rights, ending housing discrimination, and said, "I am somebody," that encouraged activists of today to stand up and fight against 400 years of racist policies in the United States. Jackson's family includes his wife of 63 years, Jacqueline Jackie Jackson, and six children. In 1999, he fathered a child with Karen Stanford, the director of the Washington Bureau of his organization, the Rainbow Push Coalition. He first publicly acknowledged his daughter Ashley in 2001 and apologized for his affair. Kristen Clark, the former Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights under the Biden-era Department of Justice, said in a statement that Jackson helped make America a more just nation. "A tireless and extraordinary public servant. His charge to all of us was to stay hopeful, keep up the good fight, and respect the dignity and humanity of all people. Jackson has been and will always be a central part of the story regarding America's ongoing quest for justice and equality." Questions arise over payouts by FEMA. "Officials Get Theirs as Other Fire Victims Wait" by Michael Collins. Sarah Jo Matthews and her family did their part to fight the wildfire that ravaged New Mexico. By the time it was over, her businesses had suffered substantial losses. She's still waiting for a payment from the federal government to help her recover. The wait has been frustrating, but making matters worse, while she's in limbo, the government employee responsible for distributing payments to people whose homes and businesses were destroyed or damaged has already received a six-figure payment. "They cannot figure out for the life of them how to pay us," said Matthews of Las Vegas, New Mexico, "but they sure as hell figured out how to pay themselves." 4 years after the fire, the worst in New Mexico's history, FEMA is facing questions about how it has administered a compensation fund set up by Congress to help the wildfire victims. Critics are demanding to know how the money has been distributed, who has received it, and whether it's going to the people who need it most. People who have filed claims complain that the review process has been complicated, frustrating, and painstakingly slow, and that cases are closed with no notice and no money awarded for their losses. "Getting money from FEMA is like getting blood from a rock," Matthews said. "They're not giving us anything." On February the 12th, FEMA placed the director in charge of distributing the money and his deputy on administrative leave, after revelations that each received a six-figure payout through the program, while other victims are waiting for their claims to be processed. Jay Mitchell, who works out of the FEMA claims office in Santa Fe, and his wife Lisa, a real estate broker, were awarded $524,000 through the compensation fund last year, according to documents. The money was to be used to repair smoke and ash damage to the couple's home in Angel Fire and to cover Lisa Mitchell's reported business losses, the documents say. An independent news outlet called Source News Mexico was the first to report the payments. Lisa Mitchell said in a brief phone interview that she and her husband have been unfairly targeted. "We're being harassed for absolutely no wrongdoing," she said. Jay Mitchell's deputy, Jennifer Carbajal, and a woman named Jennifer Sanchez, identified in local news reports as Carbajal's ex-wife, also received $267,000 for smoke and ash cleaning and for flooding at a consulting business in Penderes, the reports show. FEMA and Carbajal did not respond to requests for comment, but Paul Judson, a deputy assistant administrator in FEMA's headquarters in Washington, stressed in an email to staff of the Santa Fe office that the decision to place Mitchell and Carbajal on leave does not necessarily reflect the finding of wrongdoing. Judson did not say how long either would remain on leave or whether they will be paid while they are away. Joanne Ayala, a senior FEMA official, will oversee the office's daily operations, he said. Criticism of FEMA's handling of the payments comes as the agency is already under intense scrutiny in Washington. President Trump's administration has initiated a dramatic overhaul of the agency, which is responsible for coordinating the federal government's response to natural disasters. Trump has repeatedly characterized FEMA as ineffective and has pushed for states to have a larger role in a disaster response. Hundreds of jobs at the agency have been eliminated since Trump began his second term last year. A lawsuit filed in January by employees' unions and public interest groups claims the Department of Homeland Security plans even deeper cuts, with more than 10,000 of the agency's roughly 20,000 employees expected to be terminated in the coming months. Questions about the agency's handling of the compensation fund for the wildfire victims and the disclosure that Mitchell and Carbajal each received large payments have infuriated several of the state's elected leaders and families and business owners who are still waiting for their claims to be processed. "It's a slap in the face that Mr. Mitchell and his wife got paid out," said Maria Lowe, a community activist who's been assisting people with their claims. "He should be ashamed of himself." Matthews and her family did what they could to help friends and neighbours as the flames scorched and scarred just about everything in their path. They housed firefighter crews on their ranch. Her restaurant, the Prairie Hill Cafe, provided meals to neighbours whose homes or businesses were destroyed or heavily damaged. Her father, Owen Matthews, who owns a gravel and welding digging company, dispatched water trucks that helped save other people's homes. Matthews vividly remembers riding in one of his father's water trucks through thick smoke as black as the night to help family members and other ranchers save their homes. At one point, a state trooper who had blocked the road with his vehicle stopped them and said they wouldn't be allowed to continue. It was too dangerous, he said. The truck driver, one of her father's employees, told the officer to move his car and let them through or he'd run over it. You'll have to shoot us to stop us, he said. Matthew's father suffered smoke inhalation while helping battle the flames and had to be hospitalized. He now has permanent lung damage. But people like him weren't willing to watch their homes and ranches go up in flames without a fight. We are stewards of our land, Sarah Jo Matthews said. They were not going to abandon their ranch that's been here for generations, and their sheep and their horses and their cows to let them burn. They stayed and fought. The destruction from the inferno, known as the Hermit's Peak, Carve Canyon Fire, was surreal. Over 341,000 acres of rugged mountain terrain burned across three counties in northern New Mexico between early April and late June in 2022. The conflagration started as two separate fires, one that resulted when the U.S. Forest Service lost control of a prescribed burn at the base of Hermit's Peak in the Pico Wilderness, and the other when a holdover burn pile from the previous winter reignited near Galenas Canyon. Heavy winds fanned the flames and merged the two fires into one. As many as 1,400 structures were destroyed. Dozens of others were damaged. People lost homes, cars, trucks, businesses, livestock, pets, even their land. Buildings that were left standing suffered heavy smoke and ash damage. Flooding in the following weeks and months worsened the damage and the misery. To help with the recovery, Congress created a special fund in September of 2022 and provided over $5 billion to compensate those who suffered losses. The goal was to set up a simple, expedited process to submit a claim. Jay Mitchell, who had worked for the New Mexico Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, was hired in April 2024 to oversee the FEMA claims office responsible for distributing the money. But people who sought compensation say the process for filing claims was far from quick or easy. FEMA demanded detailed paperwork such as insurance forms or payroll records that many mom-and-pop businesses didn't have. Some people filing claims complained that they spent hours gathering the necessary documents only to have FEMA lose them and ask for them again. As of February the 4th, FEMA had paid $23,000 549 proof-of-loss claims totaling $3.36 billion, according to the office of Senator Martin Heinrich, a Democrat of New Mexico. How many claims are pending is unclear. FEMA did not respond to a request to provide those numbers, but community leaders say at least 73 people who suffered total losses to their homes or businesses are still waiting for their claims to be processed. The number of pending claims is likely significantly larger since people can file multiple claims. An Inspector General's report issued on February the 24th found that 13% of claims already filed were overdue a response. Specifically, FEMA had not acknowledged 1,500 of over 11,000 active claims more than 6 months after they were filed. Lowe said at least 20 of the 75 people she has helped with their claims are still waiting to hear how much money they'll receive, if any. Top Democrats lay the groundwork for 2028. Governors say they have the receipts of success, by Philip M. Bailey and Francesca Chambers. In Washington, the way Andy Beshear sees it, the next Democratic nominee for president ought to be a governor. He runs a state himself, and he says his colleagues have a proven track record against President Trump and for struggling Americans. When the American people are hungry for someone that makes their life a little bit better or a little bit easier, that's what governors do on a daily basis, the 48-year-old Kentucky leader told USA Today. People see Democratic governors have the receipts, and Donald Trump does not. He probably doesn't like that very much. The question for rank-and-file Democratic primary voters beginning to kick the tires on early contenders, however, is more likely going to be what type of governor. California Governor Gavin Newsom, 58, seized the spotlight early last year by resisting the Trump administration's deployment of the National Guard in his state, counteracting the White House's effort to take more House seats through redistricting when other Democratic governors hesitated, and using a punchy online style going toe-to-toe with Trump and the MAGA movement. Beshear is often cast as the anti-Newsom in terms of personal background and political presentation. Coming from a red state, Trump has won three times with ease. He talks about kitchen table issues, learning Gen Z slang from his teenage children, and his Christian faith when defending abortion rights and supporting LGBTQ plus communities. Americans are already tired of the chaos and divisiveness Beshear says has been caused by the current administration, and they will be even more exhausted by 2028, suggesting Democrats aren't looking for a liberal version of Trump. I'm not going to criticize Gavin because he's in a very different position. This president attacks California and him on a daily basis, Beshear said. But for me, I'm not the guy that mocks people on social media, and if that's what Democrats are looking for, then I'm not their guy. With a few exceptions, top contenders in the shadow primary for the 2028 Democratic nominations are governors, including Beshear and Newsom, Maryland's Wes Moore, Pennsylvania's Josh Shapiro, Michigan's Gretchen Whitmer, and Illinois' J.B. Pritzker. But unlike chief state executives who have claimed the White House before, Jimmy Carter of Georgia, Bill Clinton of Arkansas, and George W. Bush of Texas, they are contending with a president of the opposite party who relishes picking fights with states and their leaders. That means the early jockeying is as much a personality question for Democrats as an ideological litmus test for how best to handle Trump and his voters ahead of the midterms. Matt Bennett, a co-founder of the centrist group Third Way, said the level of alarm about Trump among Democrats is at its maximum, from unrest over immigration enforcement to the Trump doctrine internationally. The question is how best to use that siren. Pritzker and Newsom run very blue states targeted by Trump for heavy-handed immigration enforcement, and their combative approach makes sense for them, Bennett said. But for candidates running out of swing districts or battleground states this fall, following the example set by potential contenders like Beshear and Shapiro, makes more sense, he said. So I think they're modelling the behaviour that we should be seeing from candidates, Bennett said. Moore also runs a heavily Democratic state and has ruled out running in the past, but his name keeps bubbling up on the shortlist. He has tussled with Trump over funding to rebuild the Francis Scott Key Bridge and has supported offsetting red state redistricting by redrawing the congressional maps of Maryland. In an interview on CNN's State of the Union on February the 8th, Moore denied that the push was part of a competition with Newsom. When you're watching Donald Trump in front of our face trying to ruin and trying to thwart democracy, we have an obligation to step up, he said. In the same appearance, Moore criticized Trump for a social media post he later deleted that depicted former President Obama and his wife Michelle as apes. He said it was not lost on him, as the nation's only black governor now in office, that he was not invited to a typically bipartisan event for governors at the White House later in February. You can uninvite, you can untweet, but you can never erase, Moore said. He stopped short of accusing Trump of racism. Trump's snub United Democrats this week, when at least 18 of their governors from across the country, including many of the would-be 2028 contenders, closed ranks, telling USA Today exclusively on February the 10th that they were boycotting the event. The White House reversed course on February the 11th, according to the National Governors Association, a bipartisan group, but it remained unclear whether Moore would be excluded. Shapiro, a moderate conciliator who's running for a second term this year and on a book tour, has become more vocal as of late about Trump. He accused Trump of peddling racist videos and statements amid the Obama controversy, for instance. But he emphasizes that swing states Trump carried in 2024 have Democratic governors who are focused on pragmatic leadership rather than anti-Trump rhetoric. The reason they're popular in those states is because they're delivering tangible things, he said, at a reporter roundtable hosted January 29th by the Christian Science Monitor, referring to himself, Whitmer, and others such as Wisconsin's Tony Evers and North Carolina's Josh Stein. Nonetheless, when the president aggressively demonizes political enemies and even U.S. allies like Canada and Denmark, even the most affable centrists sometimes can't help taking a shot at him. Bashir's mild-mannered persona gave way to calling the president's obsession with taking over Greenland dumb as hell at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, for example. Democrats of all stripes have adopted more coarse language since the president's return to power, exemplified last weekend by House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries' response to the president's social media posting about the Obamas. Like New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani, some Democratic governors have tried to forge a more friendly relationship with Trump. Whitner was mocked by pundits last April after she was photographed hiding behind a folder during a surprise Trump news conference when she visited the Oval Office. The Michigan governor, who was on the vice presidential nominee list in 2024, recently became vice chair of the Democratic Governors Association. In a Substack post laying out her plans to help recruit and train candidates in 2026, she said she believed Democrat successes in Michigan could be replicated elsewhere. Nowhere did she mention Trump. The last Democratic nominee, former Vice President Kamala Harris, who left every swing state to Trump in 2024 and passed last year and running for California governor this year, has also taken a hands-off approach. She recently transferred control of her campaign's X and TikTok accounts to a progressive advocacy organization and rebranded it as Headquarters. The account is managed by several of her former aides. The move allowed Democrats to push out rapid response style content to the account's 1.1 million followers, most of it aimed squarely at Trump ahead of the midterms. The former Democratic presidential nominee appears to be only tangentially involved in the efforts, serving as chair emerita of the project, while she continues a book tour about her 107-day White House campaign that has taken her to a number of early Democratic primary and battleground states. She struck at Trump in a February the 6th post on her personal account that says no one believes the White House's claim that an aide erroneously posted the video of the Obamas to Trump's social account. "We are all clear-eyed about who Donald Trump is and what he believes," Harris said. Trump is not expected to be on the 2028 ballot because of term limits, despite publicly toying with the idea. So Democrats also have to find a message that will work against the different Republican nominee. Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis are considered potential candidates. Rahm Emanuel, a veteran Democratic House member before serving as U.S. Ambassador to Japan in the Biden administration, said it's obvious the 2026 contest will be a referendum on the president and the Republicans who enable him in Congress. But Democrats, he added, must also anticipate where swing voters will be after the midterms. "If you want people to hand over the keys to the car, you've got to be able to show you can fight for America with the same vigor in which you're just fighting Trump," Emanuel told USA Today. "And so to me, you don't skate where the puck is. You know the old saying, you skate to where the puck will be." The former Chicago mayor and Obama-era White House chief of staff is considering a run for president himself. He said he plans to lay out his vision on education in a few weeks during a stop in Michigan, a key battleground state, with an emphasis on vocational training. Other likely contenders are gaining notoriety by holding the administration accountable in the present. More than any of his potential competitors, Representative Ro Khanna of California has used his online presence to challenge Vance, a likely candidate on the Republican side who, like Khanna, attended Yale Law School and has ties to Silicon Valley. In a text message, Khanna said they had held Trump and the entire Epstein class accountable by passing the underlying legislation. "This is about holding the rich and powerful who act above the law accountable," he said. Some swing state Democrats are eager to go on offense. Senator John Ossoff, 38, a potential presidential candidate, if he holds his competitive seat in Georgia this year, is calling out Trump as a fake populist. "We were told that MAGA was for working-class Americans," Ossoff said, "but this is a government of, by, and for the ultra-rich. It's the wealthiest cabinet ever. This is the Epstein class ruling our country. They are the elites they pretend to hate." That message resonates with progressives. Joseph Givagiz, executive director of the Bernie Sanders-founded Our Revolution, said voters see for themselves who Trump is fighting for when wealthy CEOs such as Amazon founder Jeff Bezos and former Doge chief Elon Musk attend White House events. The economic populist message that Donald Trump ran on is still resonant. The issue is Donald Trump isn't delivering. He's all but walked away from the early populism that he espoused, and I think Democrats who want to win have to point that out. Uzama Andrabi, a spokesman for the Sanders-connected progressive group Justice Democrats, agreed the party doesn't have to choose between resisting the Trump administration and winning over some of the president's voters. The future of the Democratic Party demands leaders who can unite the bottom 99% across our differences against the top 1% robbing us all blind and trying to divide us against each other. Trump argued in a Fox Business interview that aired February the 10th that he had done a great job in his second term, but that the problem is voters don't see it. Democrats' manoeuvring comes as the party's base is itching to rebuke Trump. 91% of Democratic voters said in January they were extremely or very motivated for this year's elections. According to a poll released by Echelon Insights, a Republican-run opinion research firm, that's 10 percentage points higher than when Democrats were asked that same question in August and outpaces Republicans by 16 percentage points. Democrats can keep talking and President Trump will keep delivering, though, said White House spokesman Kush Desai in a statement to USA Today when asked about the potential 2028 field of Democratic candidates. But it was less than a year ago when Democrats were in the tank with voters, poll shows, and recent surveys show a record high 45% Americans are turning their backs on both parties and identifying as independents. Beshear heads the Democratic Governors Association, which nabbed wins in 2025 contests in Virginia and New Jersey, largely thanks to an emphasis on affordability. But those were states Harris won. And in 2026, Democrats have to defend governorships in six of the seven swing states that Trump won in the 2024 election: Arizona, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, and Wisconsin. Democratic governors have the receipts on making life more affordable, Beshear said. They have also served as the last line of defense against the administration on issues such as immigration enforcement, but he warned against diving too far to the left. I think a whole lot of the country feels, rightly or wrongly, that the pendulum swung too far to the left during the Biden administration and that it's swinging way too far to the right during the Trump administration, and they just want to stop it swinging, he said. Father of alleged school shooter on trial, the Georgia man faces murder and other charges by Christopher Kahn and Nadia Yancey Bragg. Opening statements and witness testimony began on February the 16th and the trial of a father whose son is accused of fatally shooting two teachers and two classmates at a Georgia high school in 2024. Colin Gray is accused of providing the gun that his son Colt Gray used in the attack at Appalachie High School. The father faces 29 charges, including second-degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, and reckless conduct. The case is among a growing number of prosecutions against parents in connection with shootings carried out by their children. So far, Gray is the only parent in such a case to face second-degree murder charges, a result of a recent Georgia law that made negligence a factor that could lead to murder charges. Prosecutors say Gray gave his son the weapon used in the deadly shooting for Christmas in 2023, months after his son had been accused of threatening a school shooting online. At the time, a sheriff's deputy told Gray to lock up his firearms. Officials also say Colt Gray had a shrine in his bedroom to Nicholas Cruz, the gunman who fatally shot 17 people at a Florida high school in 2018. Family members told investigators they believed it was a joke and didn't take it seriously. But the younger Gray had struggled with mental health issues, and his father had sought counseling for him. Barrow County District Attorney Brad Smith told the jury, "The trial is not about holding parents accountable for what their children do, but about the horrific consequences of Gray's actions. This case is about this defendant and his actions, and allowing the child that he has custody over access to a firearm and ammunition after being warned that that child was going to harm others," Smith said in his opening statement. Defense attorney Brian Hobbs told jurors that Gray did not know his son was plotting an attack because he was hiding his plan. Evidence will show the younger Gray was capable of living a double life, Hobbs said. On September the 4th, 2024, authorities say Colt Gray brought an AR-style rifle to school in Winder, Georgia, and killed Mason Schmerhorn, 14, Christian Angulo, 14, Richard Aspinwall, 39, and Christina Imrie, 53. 9 others were injured, and at the time of the shooting, Colt Gray was 14. The younger Gray's case remains pending, although defense lawyers previously indicated that a plea agreement was in the works with the district attorney's office. Two dead after shooting at Rhode Island High School hockey game. Family dispute is cited amid pure chaos. By Natalie Naser Allund, Paul Edward Parker, Michael Lauria, and Ty Nugan. A shooting during a youth hockey game in Pawtucket at Rhode Island left two people dead and three others critically injured on February the 16th, authorities said, the latest gun violence tragedy to rock the state. Pawtucket Police Department Chief Tina Culvers said the shooting occurred during a high school hockey game at the Dennis Lynch Arena, located 5 miles northeast of Providence. Culvers added that the shooting was targeted and appeared to be related to a family dispute. It appears that a lone individual, the suspect, entered the arena to watch the hockey game of a family member, and unfortunately during that time a shooting occurred. Culvers later said that the shooter, identified as Robert Dorgan, who also went by the name Roberta Esposito and was born in 1969, appeared to have died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Authorities have not identified any of the victims, but Culvers said it appeared that both victims who were killed were adults. One individual was a family friend, but didn't clarify whether the family friend was injured or killed. She noted that the three people injured in the shooting remained at the hospital in critical condition. Multiple law enforcement agencies and several local police departments responded to the incident on February the 16th. Culvers said a good Samaritan stepped in and intervened during the shooting, attempting to subdue the suspect. Pawtucket Mayor Don Grieben said the three victims injured in the shooting are in the hospital fighting for their lives. Anderson Cooper is leaving 60 Minutes. The correspondent wants to spend time with his kids by Kimmy Robinson. Anderson Cooper is leaving 60 Minutes after nearly two decades as a correspondent for the CBS News program. Being a correspondent at 60 Minutes has been one of the great honours of my career. I got to tell amazing stories and work with some of the best producers, editors and camera crews in the business, Cooper said in the statement. For nearly 20 years, I've been able to balance my jobs at CNN and CBS, but I have little kids now and I want to spend as much time with them as possible while they still want to spend time with me, he said. The journalist will leave the program when his contract expires. For more than two decades, Anderson Cooper has taken 60 Minutes viewers on journeys to faraway places, told us unforgettable stories, reported consequential investigations, and interviewed many prominent figures. CBS News said in a statement, "We're grateful to him for dedicating so much of his life to this broadcast and understand the importance of spending more time with family. 60 Minutes will be here if he ever wants to return." Cooper, who also has worked for CNN since December 2001 and hosts Anderson Cooper 360, has collected a handful of Emmy wins and nominations for his work on the Sunday Night News magazine, which is in its 58th season. His most recent appearance was on February the 15th in the Last Minute segment. CBS News has undergone several shakeups since Paramount Skydance CEO David Ellison named the Free Press founder and opinion writer Barry Weiss editor-in-chief in October. Her hiring stirred controversy over her lack of experience in broadcast news. The network's decision to pull a 60-minute segment featuring a mega-prison in El Salvador housing migrants who were deported from the United States hours before its airing in December drew backlash and accusations that the move was politically motivated. The next month, inside CECOT, which CBS had initially said needed additional reporting, aired with more details, including comments from the DHS. Robert Duvall, 1931-2026. Oscar winner reached for truth in his roles. The Godfather and Lonesome Dove showed his range, by Brian Alexander and Anna Kaufman. Robert Duvall, the Academy Award-winning actor known for his roles in Hollywood classics such as The Godfather and Apocalypse Now, has died, He was 95. Duval died peacefully at home on February the 15th in Middleburg, Virginia. A representative for the actor confirmed. He was with his wife, Luciana. To the world, he was an Academy Award-winning actor, a director, a storyteller. To me, he was simply everything, Luciana wrote on Facebook. His passion for his craft was matched only by his deep love for characters, a great meal and holding court. For each of his many roles, Bob gave everything to his characters and to the truth of the human spirit they represented. And in doing so, he leaves something lasting and unforgettable to us all. During a 7-decade stage, TV and screen acting career, Duval disappeared into a stunning range of strong-willed characters, leading to 7 Oscar nominations and a Best Actor win for his role as a down-and-out country singer in 1983's Tender Mercies. He also won 2 Primetime Emmys and 4 Golden Globe Awards for his work. He played a wide array of unforgettable men, from mafia lawyer Tom Hagen in Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather to the surf and napalm-loving Lieutenant Colonel Bill Kilgore in Coppola's 1979 Vietnam War saga Apocalypse Now, in which Duval utters the immortal line, "I love the smell of napalm in the morning. It smells like victory." His domineering Marine pilot patriarch Bull Meacham in The Great Santini burst onto movie screens in 1979, earning another Oscar nomination. And just for good measure, he appeared that same year as General Dwight D. Eisenhower in the miniseries Ike, The War Years. Also on TV, he became Joseph Stalin in 1992 Stalin, Nazi Adolf Eichmann in 1996 The Man Who Captured Eichmann, and his favourite role, Texas Ranger Captain Augustus Gus McCrae in the 1989 miniseries Lonesome Dove. Still, Duval, who obsessed over tango dancing when he wasn't acting, felt all of these characters came from within. "Has to be. It's you underneath," Duval told 60 Minutes in 2004. "You interpret somebody. You try to let it come from yourself." Born Robert Selden Duval on January the 5th, 1931, to Korean Navy officer and later Admiral William Howard Duval and actress Mildred Virginia, Duval told USA Today in 2014 that it was his mother who ran the show growing up. "It was supposed to be when the military guy comes back, she imperceptibly gives him the power to run the family until he goes away again," Duval said. "He never had it." After a brief military stint, Duval began his acting career with off-Broadway plays in New York City, becoming close friends and often roommates with up-and-coming actors Dustin Hoffman, Gene Hackman and James Caan. The impressive stage roles landed Duval a major movie debut, the wordless but memorable Boo Radley in 1962's The Killing Mockingbird. But Duval struggled to stand out, even with significant minor roles, such as 1969's dastardly Lucky Ned Pepper, who battled to the death on horses with John Wayne's one-eyed Federal Marshal Rooster Cogburn in the classic 1969 Western True Grit, a role which won Wayne his only Oscar. He would break out in 1972's The Godfather as the indecipherable Irish Hagen, the loyal adopted family consigliere to the Corleone clan. Duval reprised his role in 1974's lauded sequel, The Godfather Part II. Described by People magazine as Hollywood's number one, number two lead, Duval didn't appear in Coppola's 1990 trilogy ending The Godfather Part III after a dispute over his paycheck compared with Al Pacino, who played family head Michael Corleone. "If they paid Pacino twice what they paid me, that's fine, but not 3 or 4 times, which is what they did," Duval told 60 Minutes, of his decision to sit out the finale. It was his movie-stealing supporting role in Coppola's Apocalypse Now that Duval earned his most widespread public acclaim. As the shirtless Kilgore, he demanded his men surf even amid a fierce battle. Throughout his career, Duval relished telling variations of fan moments centered around Kilgore's famed line. "People come up to me on the street and say, 'I love the smell of napalm in the morning,' like I never knew it and had forgotten it after I said it," Duval said with a laugh on the Bob Costas show. It's like, enough's enough, Duval reached cult-level status, portraying Texas Ranger McCrae in Lonesome Dove, based on the Larry McMurtry novels of the same name. "I remember walking into the mess hall one day on Lonesome Gov I said, boys, we're making a godfather of Westerns, Duvall told the Los Angeles Times in 2014. In 2021, he name-checked the movie to USA Today as the performance he was proudest of. The Western is our genre in the United States of America. The English have Shakespeare, the French have Molière, the Russians have Chekhov, but we have the Western, Duvall said. At the 1989 Emmy Awards, the four-part series brought in 7 wins, including Best Actor in a Miniseries for Duvall from 18 nominations. I'd said to myself, now I can retire. I've done something, he told Esquire. But Duvall, who married 4 times, never truly considered retiring from acting. In 2002, he starred, wrote, produced and directed the crime thriller Assassination Tango with his Argentinian partner Luciana Pedraza, who became his 4th wife in 2004 and shared his birthday. Portraying embattled country judge Joseph Palmer in The Judge, alongside Robert Downey as his city slicker attorney's son, Duvall pulled out his 7th Oscar nomination from the forgettable screen drama at age 84, setting a record for the oldest actor nomination since Eclipse by Christopher Plummer. Duvall forged ahead, playing racist Chicago political operative Tom Mulligan in Steve McQueen's Widows in 2018. And in 2021, he appeared in the high school football drama 12 Mighty Orphans, and in 2022, the Adam Sandler basketball comedy Hustle. The actor told Esquire that the search for the next perfect role would never end as long as he could stand. I've done a lot of crap, but I've done a lot of good stuff too, Duvall said. You always wish there was one more. It's like the great jumping horse riders, always looking for a horse, the horse. In opinion, Musk promotes white supremacy. Why is anyone still on X? Elon Musk, the world's richest man and a guy whose social media platform most companies still use, is a big fan of white people. I mean, you could say he thinks white people are super, maybe even supreme. It's almost as if he supports some kind of white supremacy or something like that. Responding to an ex-user who posted, "The Irish will become a minority in Ireland because Irishmen are afraid of being called racist and upsetting people from the third world," Musk wrote on February the 11th, "Such men are pathetic traitors." How subtle. On January the 8th, Musk reposted material from an obviously secure and well-adjusted ex-user who wrote, "If white men become a minority, we will be slaughtered. Remember, if non-whites openly hate white men while white men hold a collective majority, then they will be 1,000 times more hostile and cruel when they are a majority over whites. White solidarity is the only way to survive." Musk added 100, noting complete agreement to his repost. It's worth noting that the ex-user Musk deemed worthy of highlighting to his more than 200 million followers has posted racial slurs, anti-Semitic opinions, and this gem from February the 13th. "The white simp is to blame for feminists and Jewish supremacy. White men who are dominated by white women are the ultimate problem in the world. We must teach white men to control their women and they will control the world." Good to know that the CEO of Tesla, the number one car for people who enjoy driving in shame, is reading only the purest forms of racist online commentary. Musk owns X, formerly Twitter, and has let it morph into the online equivalent of a Cirsa 1941 Nazi bar. While many have fled the site, corporations and news organizations, including my own, along with all manner of politicians and celebrities, continue to use a platform run by a man who is unapologetically promoting white supremacist talking points. The Guardian analyzed Musk's X post from the first month of 2026 and found, "The richest man in the world posted about how the white race was under threat, made allusions to race science or promoted anti-immigrant conspiracy content on 26 out of 31 days in January. The newspaper report added, "The Tesla CEO's most recent output displays a more consistent and explicit engagement with white supremacist content and native activists than in the past. However, lending them the imprimatur of the world's richest person and spreading their ideas to his audience of over 200 million followers." Heidi Beirich, co-founder of the Global Project Against Extremism, told The Guardian, If you stripped Elon Musk's name off of these things and showed them to me, I would think this was a white supremacist. My guess is that's because he is. That's my opinion, of course, supported by facts I've already presented. Musk has consistently denied being racist or anti-Semitic or any of those white supremacist-y things. But if there's one thing I found about racists in my years on this planet, it's that they deny being racist despite saying a lot of racist things. They seem to think the words that fall out of their mouths make sense, and it's the fault of others if they take them the wrong way. The reason this all matters so much is we're not talking about some random garbage poster spewing hate from an anonymous social media account. We're talking about the richest man in the world, a man who wields a massive megaphone and the power via money and X to influence the ways people think and vote. On February the 15th, Musk made a historically ludicrous cry for America to maintain some form of English-Scots-Irish culture, which I assume is weirdo code for white. For a country to survive, there has to be a common culture. Nobody dies to defend a multicultural economic zone, he said. Buddy, there are some military veterans who'd like to speak with you about that nonsense. And Princeton University historian Kevin Cruz responded to Musk's claim, writing on his Campaign Trails blog, "There's an extensive literature that tracks the ways in which concepts of diversity have stood at the heart of the United States of America from the founding. The founding generation believed in the ideal so much they put it on the seal of the United States, E pluribus unum, or out of many, one." After all these years of watching movies with billionaire supervillains, we finally have one in the flesh, but far too many people continue to act like it's no big deal. Companies and people in every entity I can think of should have gone long ago dropped X like a bad habit, which it was. Promoting your product or your brand on a social media platform owned by a guy who thinks that white solidarity is the only way to survive is several steps beyond problematic. Musk's brand of white genocide conspiracy theory nonsense was once found only in the darkest corners of the internet. Now he has mainstreamed it, and he's pulling people down a rabbit hole that can lead to horrifically bad places. I haven't posted on X for some time. My account there still exists, but only because I got locked out when I left and haven't been able to get back in to delete the whole thing. Let it rot, I say. It's time to encourage any and all who still use that site to consider who and what they're tacitly supporting. It's a white guy who really thinks white people are great, like to an increasingly uncomfortable degree. The writer and columnist Rex Hoopka can be found on Blue Sky and on Facebook. In sports, Winter Olympics. USA women's hockey goaltending powers 5 straight shutouts in pursuit of Olympic gold by Helena St. James. In Milan, Erin Frankel banged her stick on the ice, banged it some more. At the other end of the ice, her USA women's hockey teammates swarmed Sweden. After a period that put Frankel on pace to see but a handful of shots, the Swedes gave their best push to start the second period of the early semi-final on February the 16th at the Santa Giulia Ice Arena. At stake was a spot in the Winter Olympics gold medal game. Frankel helped secure USA's spot there with a 21-save performance in a 5-0 victory. The women go into the final with a remarkable 5-game shutout streak. "The team is playing so well in front of me defensively," Frankel said. "They're making my job easier, making the plays in front of me predictable so I could do my job. I think we're all just playing together as a group and that's our strength. This group is so good because of how we play together. So any time I can just focus on my job and let them do theirs, because that's why we're finding so much success, and that makes us a pretty hard team to score on." It was Frankel's 3rd shutout, setting a single tournament Olympic record. She and Gwyneth Phillips give their teammates an unshakable sense of calm. "I think our goaltending is everything," Layla Edwards said. "Even if other teams aren't getting too many shots, it's because we're allowed to play aggressive and confident, knowing who we have backing us up." The United States versus Canada game is at 1:10 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow. Working Winning Mums. Maya's Taylor Golden as Humphreys finishes third. Ilana Maya Taylor's boys are too young to realize that Mum is an Olympic champion. Kaylee and Brewster Humphreys' son just wanted to play in the snow around the medals podium where his mum had just stood. But every woman who's ever tried to juggle motherhood and a career, who's felt as if she's giving everything she's got and more and still coming up short, they'll know. And Myers Taylor and Brewster Humphreys hopes they'll see a little of themselves in the two women on that Olympic podium. I hope it shows that just because you're a mum doesn't mean you have to stop living your dreams, said Myers Taylor, who finally got the Olympic gold medal she has sought so long by winning the monobob on February the 16th, finishing ahead of Germany's Laura Nolte, who won silver, and Brewster Humphreys, who claimed the bronze medal. The standards for any woman are impossible. Add a family in whatever fashion it is, and it gets exponentially more difficult. Add getting older in a society that considers women over the hill before they're eligible to run for president, and you might as well be scaling the mountain on which the Milan Cortina bobsled track is located. Myers Taylor and Brewster Humphreys have felt that, have felt all that. 2 nights earlier was the first time Humphreys had been apart from her son since he was born, and it gutted her. She knew she needed rest, though. She is competing in the Olympics after all, and she wouldn't get it with a toddler who still wakes up in the middle of the night. Myers Taylor and Brewster Humphreys are the first to acknowledge they are not doing it alone. They both have husbands who are supportive and, as former bobsledders, understand the grind. They have families who pitch in. But no one else can quiet the voice in your head that every working mother has. No one can weigh the conflicting choices and decide what sacrifices are acceptable. No one else can tell them it's okay when priorities change or give them permission to put themselves first. I hope this inspires other people to go out and chase their dreams, whatever it may be, Brewster said. I grew up in the sport. When, if you have kids, once you get to 40, it's all downhill. And Elena and I get to be proof that that's not true. It might look different than when you're 20, but it doesn't mean that you can't stand on top of the podium. It doesn't mean that you can't go out there and achieve your dreams. And that's all we have time for today with the USA Today. This is Alison Davies saying goodbye. I hope you all stay safe and well. I look forward to reading for you next week. Goodbye.